So normally I do Bible studies more interactive, almost always. Today is not very interactive because it's actually a sermon I gave. But if you have questions along the way, please feel free to raise a hand, interject if something's not clear, if you have other questions. But I thought it would be interesting to bring to you as a Bible study. I originally gave this as a sermon for atonement because of the subject matter, and you'll see as we get going into it. But there's a lot of history there, and I'm a fan of history. I love reading history. I read a lot of history, especially when I was a boy. But what I like more than just history in general is I like seeing the connections within history. I like seeing how things came to be the way they are, how things progressed through time. Because without an understanding of history, we tend to think humanly that we're the pinnacle of everything, that we figured out things that people haven't before. We're morally superior or intelligent or more clever than previous generations. I was having this conversation with Mr. Randy Stiver yesterday. We were actually talking about some things for the Challenger East camp that he heads up in the summer. But, you know, you look back even in the Bible, if you look at how Egypt built most of what they built, they shaped those stones, they carved those monuments with copper chisels. How do you carve with copper? Anybody pounded on copper before? Not very hard, is it? Well, there's an alloy. There's tin that they learned how to mix in with it. It gave it strength, durability. They could shape these blocks in a way that we didn't figure out until our current history. What I also find interesting in history is that whatever exists now, wherever we have come to now as a culture, was shaped by something earlier. We see that in a negative way in this culture. We're running away from our religious history. This nation was very much founded on religious principles. And yet people want to run away from that. And because of that, then they forget why we are where we are. Why is this nation blessed? It's not because we've stolen from the world, because God blessed this nation. What I'd like to do then is begin to walk you through some of this. Any of you know what this is? It might be a little hard to tell from that. It's a loom, and it's actually binary code. Most people don't think of looms being binary code, but what we have and what we use in our computers, all computer technology, your cell phone, all of that runs on binary code, ones and zeros, on and off. And how you put that together in a series, then you can do the things that we can do with computers. Well, they figured this out back in the mill looms of the 1700s. Those dots represented on, and the white spot where there wasn't a dot represented off. And as they mechanized these looms, then they would get the various patterns that they could make into the cloth. This morphed into what was later called the punch cards. Anybody remember punch cards from the computer technology? God forbid you should ever drop your stack. Anybody ever do that? I remember some of those days. But then the punch card system then morphed into what we have now as the computer systems. Next, we have a barometer. We don't think of this as any big deal. Most of us probably don't even use a barometer today. But the technology that ended up allowing this to be created also helped to create the thermometer. We all use the thermometer. We want to know how cold or hot it is outside. If you look at as those fronts come through, those barometers help us to make sense of the weather patterns. Does anybody know why these were created, barometers and thermometers? What drove the invention of that technology? Deep mining. They had a problem with water. They couldn't get water out of the deep mines. It would begin to seep in. Well, that's a problem if you want to extract something. Eventually, it's going to fill the mine. And so the barometers allowed them to understand the pressures. And they would use the pressure to extract the water. But in learning how those pressures worked, they created things like barometers and thermometers. Most of you probably know what this is. Yes? No? Gutenberg's press. Okay, what throws many people off is that he actually repurposed a wine press. And that's where he got that frame. But the explosion of recorded knowledge, as we understand it, came through the invention of this press. what Gutenberg invented was not printing. Printing existed. You have blocks, wood blocks that you could carve items into. You had scrolls you could write on. So it wasn't that he invented printing. What Gutenberg did was he married a couple of different technologies that had not been thought of in that way before. Most, at the top of it, I should say, most pertinent is the creation of metal cast type that you could then put together to create words, sentences, lines. Do you know where we get the terms upper, lowercase? For capital letters, we say uppercase. For lowercase, that used to be called uncial type. That was lowercase. The typesetters would have trays of these letters. Capital letters were in the upper tray. Lowercase letters were in the lower tray. And so then as they put this together, they needed an uppercase letter and then a lowercase letter and so forth. And they built these line by line. The metal technology existed. Gutenberg invented the process to cast the letters so that then they could be inked and printed from. I find these types of connections very interesting in history because it shows how mankind has accumulated knowledge and how he has built on that over time. And the reason why I bring all of this up is that we can oftentimes forget that even in terms of our calling, those faithful down through time, whom God has used to record and explain his plan of salvation, function much the same way. We think in the church that we have the pinnacle of knowledge of what God has revealed to his church. And in some cases, that's the case. But in a lot of cases, that's not the case. You know, we have in our recent history someone like Mr. Armstrong, who God used powerfully to bring truth back to his church. But if we look back in time, there's Isaiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, Enoch, all the minor prophets, many, many others. But even in my personal research into the history of the Church of God, one of the regular hallmarks of who was a part of the true church was whether or not they kept the holy days, most specifically what we call Passover. So, as I said, I gave this, excuse me, my finger got a little ahead of there. I gave this originally on the Day of Atonement, and I was tying this into God's holy day plan. And what many don't realize now is how that plan plays out. You and I do, those that God has opened their minds to this understanding. But you and I have a part of the history of this. Because as we look at this screen here, trumpets has not been fulfilled. These previous ones have been. We understand that. Trumpets has not yet been fulfilled. Atonement, Tabernacles, Feast of Tabernacles, Last Great Day. Those have not yet been fulfilled. We have a part in that history. Not only can we be an example now of God's way of life and how it works, how it should be, but we have a role, if you will, as being part of the first fruits. The examples of those that God will use, I think, will be used as resurrected saints. I think he's going to point to us in part and say, these were ones I worked with. You thought all that was impossible. I didn't care. I wasn't interested, whatever, or I didn't even exist. But these were ones who lived that life. So we're going to take a look at this today. Because as I said, the point of atonement is to be at one with God. That's the lesson of that day. How do we do that? Well, that lesson isn't relegated only to the Day of Atonement. This is something that we should be practicing on a daily basis. How do we do that? Well, let's look at this in Leviticus 23. This, of course, is the chapter where God laid out the holy days, the annual holy days for Israel, for all of mankind. And to break into the thought for the Day of Atonement, that section is from verse 26 down through verse 32. So he says, the Eternal spoke to Moses, saying, the 10th day of the 7th month shall be a Day of Atonement, shall be a holy convocation for you, shall afflict your souls, an offering of made by fire to the Eternal. Shall do no work on that same day, for it is a Day of Atonement, to make atonement for you before the Eternal your God. For any person who is not afflicted in soul on that same day shall be cut off from his people. Any person who does any work on that same day I'll destroy. You shall not do any manner of work. It shall be a statute forever. So, again, we've rehearsed this numerous times, some of us for decades, to be reminded of what this affliction means. And this affliction here means at its core, it talks about being humbled, of having a humble heart. And that means to be teachable. A humble heart doesn't think that it knows everything, that it's being open to being taught more or a deeper understanding. But at the core of that day as well is who is not humble and who is not at one with God. We touched on this in the sermon, that Satan is the one who wants to seek to destroy what God has started. That Satan is the first who promoted a way of living in opposition to God, with the angels initially and all through mankind's history. We have the example, that we don't need to read this for the sake of today, but Ezekiel 28 talks about the king of Tyre. Many misunderstand this chapter. Many say that that's not talking about Satan, but it very directly is, because it talks about this king in light of things that would apply to no human person, no human being. We see from that section of scripture that Satan's ego lifted him up and it led him to rebel. And in doing so, he brought sin into the universe. Sin he enticed mankind to follow. And for the last 6,000 years, that has given mankind ample evidence of the fruit of following Satan's way. You know, the world is broken. It only gets worse. We keep thinking if we throw enough resources or money or time that things will change, but they don't. They just get worse. So in light of all that, then in Revelation 18, let's turn there. We have an interesting verse as John begins to wrap up what Christ inspired him to record. A statement is made here. Revelation 18, verse 4. John writes, "Then I heard another voice from heaven saying, 'Come out of her, my people.'" And he's talking about Babylon in the previous sections. He's talking about the beast and the false prophet, the scarlet woman, and all of these symbolic things that God is showing. He's talking about a political world and a religious world that is in direct opposition, active opposition to God and his way of life. So then admonition here is to come out of her, my people, lest you share of her sins, lest you receive her plagues. Verse 5, "For her sins have reached to heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities." Now, I'm talking about all of this in light of history. And we can think, well, we're not part of that system. We're not part of Babylon. Babylon ceased a long time ago. But I would make the case here that that's not the case. We have, as another reference, Jeremiah 51, verse 7, where it says, "The nations have drunk of her wine." They have become drunk following her. What that means is, although Babylon itself does not exist, the institutions, the perspectives, the values, everything that it represented has been perpetuated down through time. That's what Revelation 18:4 is talking about. We can forget, because we're in the middle of it, we can forget the history that brought us to where we are. So let's go back a bit here, and let's look at some of the history to the point when Satan laid the foundation for what we have seen since the post-flood time frame. So that's an illustration from the old Bible series, the booklet, and it shows the ark on Mount Ararat and all the animals being loose now after the flood. The flood was necessary. Most people see that as a God that's vengeful, that's angry, that's capricious, that doesn't care about his creation or human life. That's not the case. Reread Genesis 6, we find that the world had become so corrupt, God said, "I have to stop this or they will end all life." Now, that's an interesting thought even of itself. We think in our modern culture we have chemical weapons, biological weapons, nuclear weapons. Certainly we see how it's possible to erase all life. How would they have done that pre-flood? I have to wonder if they didn't have technology of some sort that would have allowed them to do that. We'll find out. That's one of the curious things I want to find out. But God brought the flood, nonetheless. He cleansed the earth. He stopped that. He started over with Noah and his family. And after the flood, mankind was small in numbers, obviously. There were 8 people that went into that ark. How many people came out? We're not told if there were babies born during that time, but we are told later that there were. Well, let's go back to Genesis chapter 10. Genesis chapter 10 And this chapter is known by many as the Table of Nations, because as mankind began to expand in population after the flood, then we have various families that become various nations. And that's the way this works. Nations are just families gotten big. So Genesis 10 and verse 1, it says that this is the genealogy of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, Japheth, and sons were born to them after the flood. Let's skip down to verse 6. The sons of Ham were Cush, Mizraim, Put, Canaan. Sorry, I lost my place. The sons of Cush were Sheba, Hevelah, Sabta, Rama, Sabtek. The sons of Rama were Shebna, Dedem. Cush begat Nimrod, verse 8. He began to be a mighty one on the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Eternal. Therefore, it is said, like Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Eternal. In the beginning of his kingdom was Babel, Erech, Akkad, Kalna, and the land of Shinar. So here we're introduced to Nimrod. Nimrod was the son of Cush, the great-grandson of Noah. Oftentimes we can easily read over these genealogies, but it gives us insight into the connections, even in this history. In verse 8, where it says, he began to be a mighty one on the earth, in the Hebrew can also simply be translated that he became a tyrant, meaning he sought to control people. In verse 9, the phrase, a mighty hunter before the Lord, can also be translated instead of. In other words, he was pointing people to him instead of pointing them to God. That is, Nimrod became the one that he said people should follow. Now, the time frame here is about 2200 BC in rough numbers. So 2200 years before Christ. It's only a few decades, depending on how you count it, up to about 100 years or so after the flood. So it didn't take very long for mankind to revert, to go back to what God had to correct through the flood. Now, Nimrod's history is fuzzy, but we do have connections in history. We do find certain things. Nimrod lived and reigned roughly prior to the time of Abraham. One of the things I want to do to you, for you in the near future, one of these Bible studies, is I created a timeline at the request of my son, who is more of a visual learner. And he said, you know, when we read the Bible, it's hard to put these things in context. When this happened compared to that, because the Bible's not written chronologically. And so I created a timeline from creation up until roughly the time of the first century church, putting all of that in a chronology. And it's very enlightening to show you some of that. I'll do that in the future. But Nimrod lived prior to Abraham. And you can see that in the following verses here in Genesis 10, if you want to read that. But Nimrod was the first of the Assyrian kings. Now, historians of the world discount this history, but there is record of this. They say Assyria didn't exist until 1,000 years later. But what they forget is where that came from. Nimrod was the first of those kings. He founded Nineveh, the city Nineveh. He was the first to conquer other nations through warfare, to subdue people, to create cities. He lived in opposition to God because what was the directive God gave Noah and his sons after the flood? Anybody remember? Anson? Fill the earth, meaning go forth. I want you to go and fill the earth, not stay here. Go out. I made this whole planet for you. They didn't do that. They gathered in cities. Now, think about this also in terms of the reality of the life they had. They were small in numbers. Animals multiply much quicker, don't they? They'll have litters, some animals of 10, 12 pups, kits, depending on what animal it is. And so you can see very quickly how these wild animals would have been a problem. And someone like Nimrod could make a very compelling case. I've built these walls. You can stay safe in here at night, but you have to live by my rules. So, wait, before I leave this, I'll explain some of this. This is a section of that chart that I made. And I can't read it from this angle, but you can see the sons here. Arphaxad was the grandson of Noah. We oftentimes think that lineage died shortly after the flood. Our facts had lived way down until the times of the patriarchs. That knowledge would have been passed on, knowledge of God's way of life. So then you have these various sons that progress down here, Terah, and then Abraham. I skipped up. So Abraham was a descendant of Terah. But notice where Abraham fits in here. He would have known Noah. He would have known Arphaxad. He would have known all of these individuals. So, again, we think of Abraham being somebody that God plucked out of obscurity. No, he had a legacy. He had a history, his own history, connected to the truth. That's an aside, but that's part of that chart that I made. This image here is an image of Nimrod. He's often shown holding a lamb as a hunter or a doe, but he's giving these wings and a branch. These are some of the symbols that he's given. So moving on here, this is a quote from Josephus, and he writes this about Nimrod. It says, "Now it was Nimrod who excited them," meaning those of the post-flood world, "to such an affront and contempt of God. He was a bold man and of great strength of hand," meaning strong physically, very imposing man. "He persuaded them not to ascribe it to God, as though it were through his means they were happy." Meaning, he didn't say, you have blessings of life, you have protection, you have the abundance of the world around us through God. He didn't point them to God. But rather, he taught them to believe that it was their own courage which procured that happiness. He also gradually changed the government into tyranny, seeing no other way of turning men from the fear of God, but to bring them into a constant dependence upon his own power. Do we see that in a modern context? Where governments lead citizens to a point where they have to have the government to have the things of life they want. And I'm not just talking about this nation. This exists all around the world. He also said he would be revenged on God if he should have a mind to drown the world again. And so this is part of why God hated what they were doing with the tower. The tower was not a benign monument. The tower was an affront. Some of you will recognize some of the gestures that I'm alluding to. You know, where they'll use gestures, you know, so much as, you know, I can't say it politely in any way, you know, but basically telling God to go take a flying leap. They thought that if they built the tower high enough, the flood levels would never reach the top. God could not kill them. That was the purpose of the tower. So let me fill in some of this history here of Nimrod and some of the ones connected to him. Semiramis, also known as Ninus, or the son Ninus or Tammuz. After Genesis 10 here, we don't hear anything in Scripture regarding Nimrod, but there are several traditions that abound. One account has Semiramis, who was his wife slash mother. Imagine that made family gatherings rather interesting. But has her killing him, killing Nimrod, but using that death to deify him. That he was a god. He didn't die. He became a god. And that her illegitimate son, some claim that she was actually the power behind the throne, that she became pregnant through an affair, she killed her husband, and she used her son, and various translations have it different ways. Some call him Ninus, but a name in Scripture you might be more familiar with is Tammuz. We'll read a reference to that here in a moment. But that Tammuz was Nimrod reborn, the son reborn. Another tradition is that Shem killed Nimrod for his apostasy before God. Shem had had it up to here, and he decided, much like we have other examples later in Scripture, that he was simply going to kill this man before he created more trouble. Some traditions go on to say that he cut up his body as a warning to others that would follow the teachings of Nimrod. Even in historical circles, it's noted before this time that mankind seemed to be a fairly homogeneous group in terms of politics and religion and culture, but something changed. The historians don't know what changed. What changed was Nimrod and the Tower of Babel. God scattered everybody. Now they have different languages. They have different cultural customs. This compounding of languages would also force mankind to fulfill the edict God gave them. I don't understand you, so I'm going to go live over here. And they end up migrating out. Let's continue here in Genesis, a little over in chapter 11. It says, now the whole earth had one language, one speech. This is still the time of the Tower of Babel. It came to pass as they journeyed from the east, they found a plain in the land of Shinar. Remember, this is connected to Babylon, or Babel and Nimrod back in Genesis 10:10. And it says, and they dwelt there. They didn't scatter. They said, come, let us make bricks and bake them thoroughly. So they had brick for stone. They had asphalt for mortar. Sort of like a pitch, you know, that would set. It would harden, much like asphalt. So you could use that to bind things together. So this is how they built this tower. Most historical references, illustrations, will show like a tower. But most now think that it was actually more in the form of a ziggurat, which is a stepped pyramid. Whatever the case is, they started building this. And it says, verse 5, God came down. He looked to see the city and the tower which they were building. And he said, indeed, the people are one, and they have one language. And when you're unified in that way, look at what we've been able to accomplish in a modern sense, because we understand each other. We can disseminate knowledge. We can share ideas. Not all of it's good, but look how much we've advanced. And he says, and this is what they will begin to do now that nothing they purpose will be withheld from them. Let us go down. This is another case to be made in Scripture about God not being a strict monotheistic God. We know him as a family. Let us go down and there confuse their language that they may not understand one another. And so God scattered them abroad from there over the face of the earth, and they ceased building the city. Therefore, the name is called Babel, because there the God, the Eternal confused the language of all the earth, and from there the Eternal scattered them abroad. And so then it goes on a genealogy there, from there, through down to Abraham. Mankind, as I said, this could be as short as a couple of decades. It's debatable. It could have been close to 100 years. We're not quite sure. But they were already forgetting the lessons of why God had destroyed the pre-flood world, what he had want them to do. And rather than acknowledging and seeing their own sin, the price of that sin, what it cost, and rather listening to God, they blamed God. Nimrod blamed God. And so then they used that as justification to create the world that they did. So then moving on here, they rejected God's instruction to multiply. This is one illustration of what the city of Babylon might have looked like. It was known in the ancient world to be one of the seven wonders, called the Hanging Gardens. They had created systems to pump water up so that they could water all of these gardens. It was located along the river Euphrates. But they rejected God's instructions we talked about. They listened to men like Nimrod that said they needed to gather in cities for protection from the animals or protection from God. And so the family pattern was broken. God had established the family as the authority. Now Nimrod is saying the state is the authority. Rather than instructing them to trust in God and overcome sin, now they're saying God is capricious or God doesn't exist. There is no sin. The tree of knowledge of good and evil was fully embraced. So rulership would come through power and control rather than service. We have that contrast with Christ. He said, don't rule as the Gentiles do. Don't follow the instruction, the example of the world. So Nimrod set himself up as a god. His wife Semiramis became the queen of heaven. They became deities to be worshipped. They were larger than life. They were the ones who delivered the people. Now think about how that is filtered down through all the cultures. Every religion that has followed has at its core a Trinity Godhead. Almost every religion does. That is, the Father who is the giver of life, the Son who is the deliverer of the followers, the adherents, and then the Mother through whom life flows. Now, there are various variations of this. Other gods have been added in, say, the Egyptian world and the Greek world and so forth. But at the core, you find this Trinity, this religious system that was established by Nimrod as a counterfeit, as an affront. And so the world is so steeped in this history that most don't give it a second thought. They don't consider where it came from. And this religious system has not only shaped religion, but it has shaped the way business is done, the way governments are established and run, why wars are fought, why there is so much that the world doesn't understand about God's way of life. This is when God saw that he could no longer work with mankind as a whole. Up to that point, he did. But now he chose to work through one family, descendants of Abraham. But Nimrod was the driving force of creating that Tower of Babel. So let's look at some of this in terms of coming out of her. Does anybody know what that is? It's an image of a constellation. Most of you probably will be able to recognize it in the night sky. It's what's known as Orion's Belt. All right, so you have, this is the belt, the three stars that are easily recognizable. And there are variations of this over time. Some illustrations show him, I'm sorry, I hit the wrong button here. Let me go back. Come on. Some show, instead of a lion's head and a club, show him pulling a bow with an arrow. So there are variations of that. The stars are whatever shape we want them to be. What's interesting is this is one of the oldest and most consistent constellations in almost every culture. They have this image. Now, the Greeks derived their notions of the arrangement of the zodiac from the Chaldees. The Chaldees were the ancient Babylonians. And this constellation Orion is the Mighty Hunter. Who did we just read was the Mighty Hunter? Nimrod. This constellation represents Nimrod. Even within God's church, I don't believe we give enough consideration to how much Nimrod's attitude of rebellion against God permeates everything in the world around us. Some verses you can write down. 2 Thessalonians 2:7 talks about the mystery of iniquity. Iniquity is what in Scripture? Sin, lawlessness, against the law. So iniquity is in opposition to God's instruction. This world is predisposed through the influence of Satan to be against God's law. Look at our entertainment. Look at the music culture. Look at our politics. Look at the wars we fight. It's in opposition to what God teaches. All done because of what you and I understand, what is revealed in Scripture, that there is an influence behind the world. Ephesians 2 talks about the prince of the power of the air. We probably more than any other generation, if I can use that word, of mankind should understand this. There are all kinds of signals bouncing around this room right now. I've got one right here. This remote uses a radio signal to communicate with the dongle on my computer. Our phones, there's TV frequencies, there's radio frequencies. There are all kinds of frequencies in the air around us. Satan just tunes in to our frequencies, the prince of the power of the air, and he broadcasts. Mr. Armstrong used to talk about that regularly. He broadcasts this way of thinking, this sinful nature. Now, without Satan, doesn't mean sin completely goes away. What Satan does is magnify our wrong desires. But it's more than just an attitude that Nimrod promoted. I flashed by this a couple of times. I'll put the remote down so I won't keep hitting the button. What you see there are various symbols. Some of them we think are rather benign. But at some point, all of them were used to express the Trinity. So you have examples of the Druids there in the Ireland on the far left. The apocryphal story is that St. Patrick used that to teach the Trinity doctrine to the heathen of Ireland. It's a false story. Patrick never did that. Patrick was a Sabbatarian, if you didn't know that. Actually taught against the Roman Church. They co-opted his history hundreds of years later. You also have the example in France, Fleur-de-Lis. Then you have the Celtic triangle, the Trinacrians in Italy, the Germanic, the Norse, and you can see the similarities between those. These are all promoting the Father, the Son, the wife slash mother, Trinity. From there, then we move down in time, and we come to all of these various gods that are represented. So we have Greek gods, Roman gods, Celtic gods, Hindu gods. All of them can be traced back to these derivatives of that Babylonian godhead. Hermes, as one example, was the messenger of the gods. He was the spokesman. Do we find that in Scripture? Who was the spokesman for God? Christ. John 1, he's the Word, he's the spokesman. You see how Satan co-opts this. So from these, then we have other examples. This is an interesting one. Anyone know what this God is? The Roman God. Janus. What do we use Janus for? January. He was the two-headed God, looking back, looking forward. January is at the beginning of the year, but we look back into the previous year. So you have all these examples. Then we have Isaiah 66, verse 17. This was a problem that Israel had throughout their whole history. In spite of having the God of the universe desiring to lead and teach them and to give them the life that he knew would be the most beneficial to them, they kept wandering back or over to these other gods. They always found the Canaanite gods or the Egyptian gods more enticing. And in Isaiah 66, verse 17, it says, "Those who sanctify themselves and purify themselves to go to the gardens after an idol in the midst, eating swine's flesh and the abomination and the mouse shall be consumed together." He's talking about how this has permeated Israel's history, that they're going to be judged for this, that this was a problem that Israel had. To continue the thought here, there are some other names in the various histories, if you want to study this. These are names that are connected to Nimrod. I mentioned Tammuz. We're going to read one of those scriptures here in a minute. Hermes. I think Hermes was the counterpart to Mercury, if I remember my mythology correctly. Messenger. Baal. This is why God hated their worship of Baal. What they were doing was basically acknowledging that Nimrod was their god, not God. This is why God hated that. Adonis, Jupiter, Gilgamesh. Gilgamesh was a Babylonian god. Gilgamesh wrote he's famous in historical circles because there's the Gilgamesh pillar, or I think it's called, where there's an account of a flood, much like what's in Genesis 6 and 7. But he has a much different arc. It's a cube. It would never function on the open water. But because, according to historians, that predates what Moses wrote, then Gilgamesh must have had the better story, must have had the more accurate story. Chemosh is another god that was oftentimes worshipped in Israel. Merodach, Dagon, you remember Dagon from the Philistines? Dagon was simply another variation of Nimrod. Osiris, this is an Egyptian god. These are all connected together. What's also very interesting is that Nimrod was oftentimes represented with a bull, and how oftentimes the image of a bull repeats in world imagery, religions of the world, I should say. In fact, most are not aware of it, but the EU has a very similar image. Most are familiar with the stars in a circle, but they also have an image that shows a woman riding on the back of a bull. And that's imagery right out of Revelation. This bull has been associated with Nimrod because it's a symbol of strength, power, that goes all the way back to Babylon. And then from the triune, then we get also the Madonna, or mother and child. This imagery repeats in all kinds of religions. We're probably more familiar with some of the iconography from the Middle Ages, but even in Egypt, most people don't think about that, but these are examples of all kinds of different world religions, and they have also this imagery of mother and child. It's nearly universal. In the Babylonian religion, the mother derived her glory and deification from the sun. So even in a modern context, Catholics venerate Mary as being equal or higher with Christ, depending on who you talk to. That prayers to her are more valuable because she understands better. So let's read that verse I was alluding to, Ezekiel chapter 8. And as we read it, think about what we've covered here in terms of Babylon and why God would be so upset with them. Ezekiel 8, verse 14. this chapter is talking about, God is having Ezekiel record abominations that are being done at the temple, God's temple, but that are worshiping another god. And so then to break into it, verse 14, it says, he brought me, this is Ezekiel writing under inspiration, he brought me to the door of the north gate of the Lord's house. And to my dismay, there were women sitting there weeping for Tammuz. Who is Tammuz? Nimrod. They're at one of the doors. As you faced the temple, you would be looking west. So this is to the right side. North would be to the right. So they were at one of the doors that accessed the inner court, and they're not weeping for God. They're weeping for Tammuz. And so then verse 15, he says to me, have you seen this, son of man? Turn again, you'll see even greater. So he brought me to the inner court, inside that inner court, to the Lord's house. And there at the door of the temple. Now the inner court, not everybody could go to. Only the men could go in there. Only the men of Israel could go there. And they could only go there when they were bringing a sacrifice, because the altar was right before the temple. So if you walked around the altar, you would be standing at the very steps in front of the temple. This is where Ezekiel is. He's standing at the door of the temple between the porch and the altar. There were about 25 men with their backs to the temple of the Lord. The temple faced west. So if their backs are to the temple, which way are they facing? East. They're facing east. As it says, their faces towards the east, and they were worshiping the sun. And so then he says, is this a trivial thing to do, the house of Judah, to commit these abominations? Because all of these things represented Babylonian religion, Nimrod. What's missing from the world's perspective in pondering these things is they don't have an answer to this question. Why does Christ need to return to earth? So again, I originally gave this in the context of the Day of Atonement. Why would Christ need to come back? Most religions don't have an answer to that. They just know that he is. That's, we know that's why he's coming, right, to establish his kingdom. But that's unknown to almost every religion. Why does God need to come back? See, we know that he's going to begin to establish his kingdom. The Day of Atonement answers that question. Christ has to come back because everything right now, this world is predicated on, everything that we've built on came from the inspiration of Satan. This is not God's world. Ephesians 2, the prince of this world. Yep, he's going to... Well, he's going to remove the influence. There'll still be... People will still have to make a choice up until the second resurrection. But yeah, he's going to basically wipe the slate and he's going to start over. He's not going to do... I use the analogy like in a house. He's not going to do a remodel. He's going to do a teardown. Right? There are some houses that are not worth remodeling. There's too much work, too much money. There's too many problems. So you tear it down and you start over. That's what God's going to do with this world. Because everything that's here now is built on Satan's system. You can't repair that. It was never founded on God's truth to begin with. So let's look at some of that as we wrap this up then. Revelation 20. I've often said, and I don't mean it as criticism against God, but I wish there was more time between the Feast of Trumpets and the Day of Atonement so that we'd have more time to talk about these sort of things. But they're like a little over a week apart. And so we do trumpets, then atonement, and we're off to the Feast of Tabernacles. And so oftentimes it can get short shrifted in there. So Revelation 20 and verse 1, this lays out a timeline for us. John again writes, I saw an angel coming down from heaven having the key to the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand. He laid hold of the dragon, that serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years. He cast him in a bottomless pit, shut him up, and set a seal on him that he should deceive the nations no more till the 1,000 years were finished. But after these things, he must be released for a little while. Satan will be bound, not yet permanently at this point, but he will be. He'll be removed so that constant influence is no longer there. Then let's transition to Romans 1, verse 6, 16. Romans 1, verse 16. Paul says, I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is a power of God to salvation for everyone who believes, for the Jew first, also for the Greek. For in it, the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith. As it is written, the just shall live by faith. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. So instead of God's truth, we have Christmas trees, which have their own pagan connections. So instead of God's truth, we have Easter, which is not even based on the right calendar. Instead of God's truth, we have the culture that we have around us. Verse 19, because what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, meaning we should be able to see God simply from the creation, to see his hand. And yet we argue against it. You know, the possibilities of life being created the way evolution teaches is beyond even the level of acceptability in terms of probability. Now, what that means is you go out enough decimal places and it becomes a statistical impossibility. It just simply is not going to happen. But even beyond that, you know, they talk about life being created in this primordial soup. Well, there's huge problems even with that. You know, you have cell structures that are supposed to replicate, and the likelihood that they would do that on their own is highly unlikely. But you expose that cellular structure to UV light, and it's destroyed. So you create it once. How are you going to create it twice in a row so that it can replicate before it gets destroyed? There's just all kinds of problems, all kinds of hoops you have to jump through. But just to look at how this world functions, you know, the weather that we have. This Earth is primed for life. There are some physicists, astronomers, and such, as they look out at the universe, that this Earth is just the exact distance it needs to be from Earth so it's not too hot or too cold. If it was just 1,000 miles one way or the other, we would not have life here the way we know it. We have that 20-whatever degree tilt of the Earth that makes most of the Earth habitable. If we didn't have that tilt, the polar extremes, much past the equator, you couldn't live there. And in fact, the equator would get too hot because air wouldn't move around the way it does now. The ocean currents circulate. You know, England is way farther north than we are. They don't have the winters we have because they have warm water going by it all the time. The Gulf Stream that goes by it. New England is about parallel to Wisconsin here. I thought we had hard winters until I came to Wisconsin. We don't have hard winters, or didn't in Rhode Island, not really. It's because the Gulf Stream's going by it. You know, all of these things that exist in the world. But it says, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Because although they knew God, think back to Genesis 10, 11, what we read there. They knew God. He was known to them. God didn't open the ark door. All the animals run out, and then he waves goodbye into the sunset. He instructed them. They did not glorify him, nor were they thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and the foolish hearts were darkened. Being professing to be wise, they became fools. And so we have the world around us that we have. Let's continue in chapter 8, Romans 8. I must need new batteries in this. I had problems with this remote last week in Milwaukee. That's probably why. Romans 8 and verse 14. For as you are led by the Spirit of God, for as many as are led by the Spirit of God, these are the sons of God. For you did not receive the spirit of bondage again to fear. Meaning, when God calls us, he's calling us out of bondage. The world is bondage. God's way of life is not bondage. You have received the spirit of adoption by which we cry out, Abba, Father. The spirit itself bears witness with our spirit that we are children of God. And if we're children, then heirs, heirs of God, joint heirs with Christ, if indeed we suffer with him, that we may be glorified together. That God has something much more impressive in mind than what this world promotes. It's been interesting to note we've had so many notable celebrity deaths here in the last month or so. And most of them die just hoping that they leave something for their family. There's no hope in their death. We understand the purpose of this life, that even in death, it's not done. If we go back a couple of chapters to Romans 5 and verse 10, Romans 5, verse 10, for if when we were enemies, we were reconciled to God through the death of his Son, because this world is in opposition to God, then how much more, having been reconciled, shall we be saved by his life? See, the counterfeit religion of Babylon would never bring that life. It was an empty promise. It was a creation of a false reality, if you will, that Nimrod could change things, that he would come back from the dead. I've often wondered how God will start that conversation, how he'll begin to teach people that everything they knew, everything they believed, everything they thought was of value in this world is nothing but a lie. So, as we began, we'll finish, and you don't need to turn there, I'll read it for you, but Revelation chapter 18, verse 4. I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, lest you share in her sins and you receive of her plagues. All right. Thank you very much. I don't know the progression from here, Mrs. Morrison. What do you need us to do?